Okay, we are just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As always, people will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards. And later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the chat in text format will go up on our website. Welcome all, and if we have any new people with us tonight, we do welcome guests at any of our meetings. If you want to join, come to our website, and I am pasting in where you can go, or you can just go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button near the top, and it'll walk you through the process. It's $20 a year to become a member. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, will do. First up, we had a bit of discussion last week about logging into Zoom. And over the years, we've had a few presentations on how to use Zoom. So here's another one. This is my version of signing into Zoom. I actually like using the desktop client, which is now called Zoom Workplace. And I think the latest version, although that keeps changing, is 7.1.5. And if you go to the Zoom.us website and the download page, you'll find that you're at the download center. It will recognize your operating system and offer you the client for whichever OS you're using. So in this case, I'm logged on to my Windows box and it's offering me a Zoom Workplace for Windows. So once you install that, I basically just have an icon on my desktop. I just double click on that, and it brings up the Zoom home screen. So to log on, I just hit the join command here, and it gives me it wants my login credentials. So it wants a meeting ID and a name. And if you put in your name right here, I think that's the one that it will display when you actually log in. In terms of a meeting ID, when you get the various reminders through the announcements list, you'll find that the meeting ID is specified right there, and the password. And those are static numbers. So it's always the same meeting ID, and it's always the same password, OPCUG. Pretty hard to forget the password anyway. So basically, you can just cut and paste the number there from the email into the box here, and then tell it to join. However, you'll notice that there's a chevron here, which is a drop down. And if you use that drop down, it actually shows you the various meetings that you've been to recently. So here is the OPCUG meeting ID, the Q&A sessions right now. But I've also been to some APCUG workshops and that kind of thing. So basically, I could just select this guy right here. And next thing, once I've given it the meeting ID, now it wants the password, and everybody remembers what the password is, right? And so now you can just say, join the meeting. And it gives you the option to check out your audio and video connections before you go ahead. And then once you're satisfied that those are live and working properly, then you can tell it to join. And in this case, I've logged on early and the meeting isn't going. And notice that it says it is waiting for the host to start the meeting. So nothing happens until Chris basically starts up the meeting. Once that happens, then it will actually kick in, and it tells me here that the meeting is being recorded. So if you're concerned about that, you can turn off your video camera and don't say anything. If you don't care, then whatever you say and you might be shown on the recordings. And then once you select record, then here you are on the main what does APCG call it? Hollywood Squares. So all of the various participants who are logged in at the moment are shown on the view here. And then eventually we'll go down to share a screen right here, and you'll see the actual presentation that we're looking at right now. So that's basically how I do it. I find the Zoom client really very convenient and very easy to use, and so that's the way I log on to Zoom. Okay, next up we have Chris.
Okay, just before we leave last topic, I will comment on the fact that Zoom seems to modify the behavior of the Zoom client on a fairly regular basis. They never announce what changes they're making on it. So if you at some point come in using the Zoom client and something isn't familiar looking, it's probably just that you've been updated to the latest version of the client and you have to stumble around to find the new way of doing the old action.
Like Microsoft, they change it just for the sake of change, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's go on to email tracking pixels, and I'll talk about what precipitated this particular presentation a little bit later on. It's actually kind of interesting how it came about. But so I'm doing just a backtrack on it, and that I'm talking first about what are email tracking pixels, and then I'll talk about why they were of interest to somebody. So they're typically in an email, and it'll be a tiny image file that is in the email, and it'll usually be just like 1 pixel by 1 pixel. It might be white or something like that, so you'll just never see it in the actual email as you're looking at it. So when your email app, or if you're using webmail, your browser loads the image, it will actually make a request to the sender's server in order to display that image. So it hasn't embedded it in the email. It's a reference to a web page to pick up this 1 pixel by 1 pixel image. And it can include, and typically will include, when it's a tracking pixel, it'll actually include other details beyond just the name of the graphic that is going to be displayed. So it'll have things like your email address or the email address this email was sent to, date and time, location, things like that can all be included in that call back to the server. So it is really commonly used for marketing analytics, and so this we'll see a thing later on about how this can be not exactly evil, or the intent was not really evil, but it is used for marketing purposes. And things like conversion tracking. So this will be so, you know, they can tell whether an email was open, whether a web link was actually clicked in the email, and that, you know, might result in a click to a website or a sale at a website or something like that. So they can track that sort of information. And, of course, spammers can tell you, tell when you actually opened that email. And by virtue of the fact that they can tell that the email is open, they know that the email this was sent to is a valid email and there's a person who's actually reading the email. So there are privacy concerns, both on the marketing side of things as well as spammers being able to tell that your email address is actually valid, in which case you probably get more spam. So there are privacy concerns about email tracking pixels. So some examples of how it could be used. So a retailer, you know, might send you an email with a Shop Now button. And so the email will include that tracking pixel. And when you open the email, you know, your mail program loads that image from the sender's server because the image, again, is not embedded in the email itself. It's a call to load the image from a web server. And then the server will record information about it. You know, the date, the time, all kinds of things like that can be recorded. If you actually click on the Shop Now button, they can actually load that or log it as being an engagement event. So you actually read their email and you decided to click on the Shop Now button. So they can measure, you know, which subject lines are most effective, which offers are most effective, things like that. So they can do A-B type testing where they can say, well, if we send out this email with this subject line, it caused so many people to click on the Shop Now button. If we send it with this email subject line, it recorded this many people actually engaged in it. So they can fine-tune their marketing email. And this is really why those tracking pixels are really, really popular in marketing emails. And I'll show you in a second why privacy features are actually reducing how accurately they do work, or you have the ability to reduce the effectiveness of it from a marketing point of view. And of course, the same techniques can be used by a spammer or a scammer as is used by a legitimate marketing company. So are they good or evil? You know, it sounds like tracking pixels are always evil. You know? But, you know, why do we say that? Well, a spammer can detect when you open their spam. So they know that your email address is valid. You'll likely get more spam. Criminal could send you a fake invoice email. You know, they learn various pieces of information about you. So how this came about. Karen got this email, and it was from L'École Le Parisienne. And it was somebody, she signed up for this, and they sent out this email to all the users saying that as a part of their commitment to transparency, okay, that sounds like a good thing, and in accordance with recommendations from the French Data Protection Authority, so in the EU, they're really a lot more concerned about privacy and things like that from their citizens. And they wanted to inform everybody about the use of tracking pixels. Okay, that's interesting. So then they go on to say what they use tracking pixels for. So they will detect when emails are opened. And they say it's to measure performance, improve relevance. Okay, that seems fair enough. Adjust the frequency according to the level of engagement. So if you only open up once a month, you open up their email, then maybe they'll figure out that, hey, we're emailing people too often. Automatically unsubscribe users. This is really interesting, after an extended period of inactivity. So that tells me that if your tracking pixel is never triggered, then after a while, they'll just figure that, oh, you're no longer reading our emails, and therefore we're going to unsubscribe you. I'm going to come back to that in a bit. And then create different profiles. You know, so they're profiling all their users. I'm not so sure I really like the idea of being profiled. So they do say you can object to the use of tracking pixels, and you can change your mind at any time. You can tell them basically that, you know, I don't want this to be happening, except they say tracking pixels, even when you object to it, you say, I don't want these anymore, it'll continue to be used only for the purpose of unsubscribing people who don't read their emails. Yeah, I'll come back to that. So maybe that's not evil. But if you block tracking pixels, which you can do, and I'll talk about that, you'll probably end up being unsubscribed because after a period of time, they're going to see that your email address never loaded that particular one-by-one pixel image from their server, and therefore they assume that you're not reading their email. But that may not be the case. It might be just that you're blocking those tracking pixels. So how do you block tracking pixels? So on this screen here, I have a number of different email services or email clients that allow you to actually go in and say that you do not want tracking pixels to be triggered. And so your mail client, whether it's a web browser or a standalone client, will never actually load that one-by-one pixel, or for that matter, any remote images from those emails. And so it doesn't trigger that. So here's how, in Thunderbird, I'm actually seeing an email that came in, and it has remote content. This could be full-scale graphics. It could be tracking pixels. I don't know. It's any remote content. And it says at the top, to protect your privacy, Thunderbird has blocked remote content in this message. And you have a number of options. So that's told me that it is blocking all of that remote content. If I say that I want remote content to be allowed, this is the way that same email will actually show up. And you can see that there's a couple of full-scale graphics in there. There may be some one-by-one tracking pixels as well. I don't know. But I actually am not seeing something that may be a significant portion of that particular email. So here's one where I have remote content blocked. And so this came from Canada Revenue Agency. We talked about this a week or two ago. and it came from at reflex.ca. Highly unlikely that Canada Revenue Agency is going to send from an email address of at reflex.ca. So it's probably a scam or spam or whatever. And this is an example of remote content that you actually do want to keep it blocked, because this is not legitimate emails. And if you do allow that remote content, you're almost certainly going to give away information to the sender about your email address being valid and so forth. So here's an example, and this one, we just saw this one, remote content that I may want to allow. Okay, this is coming from a known sender, you know, PC Optimum, so it's just telling me what my weekly offers are and things like that. And it's almost certainly not a scam. So what I could do is click on the chevron by the options, and there's a number of options that I have available. Show remote content in this message would be a one-time only thing that would actually happen. And then there's a bunch of ones to allow it in now and in the future. So I can see that things like, you know, one of the pieces of content is being called from clickandcollect.s3.us-east-1 Amazon AWS or their web services .com. So that sounds like an awful lot of marketing type stuff that I'm likely to not really care about. And it's almost certainly a tracking pixel. Whereas there are other ones in there, like allow remote content from link.pcoptimum.ca. That's a little bit more likely that it's actually just going to be those graphics that show up in that email as a normal thing. So in something like this, if I did want to not have to click every time I got these emails, I might want to just say, you know, allow for no reply at, but that would allow all the content, or I might want to allow it just for remote content from link.pcoptimum.ca. I don't know. But typically what I do on these ones here, I just don't allow the remote content at all. I've found that they don't really add anything that I can see to the value to the email to me. So does it totally eliminate threats? Well, probably not. Perplexity actually alludes to some other methods that could be used for tracking to see when you open up an email. But I was not able to find any details on that. So, you know, I asked the question, does anybody actually know of other methods that are used to tell whether you open an email or not? If anybody has some ideas, throw it into the chat. We could revisit it later on or, you know, do it more fully at a future Q&A. So that's it for tracking pixels.
Okay, thanks, Chris. All right, so next up we have a couple of, well, two or three things which have been provided by other people. So we're going to start off with Stuart. And Stuart wants us to know all about, he wants us to meet France, don't you, Stu?
Yeah, we want to meet France. Nice guy. I came across this thing called France. And, well, it's not for me. Like, I'm just not that popular a person. I don't have 100 friends on 15 different messaging applications all trying to talk to me at the same time. But there are lots of people like that out there, and you might be part of this group. So you might want to think about this. It's basically a communications aggregator that lets you plug all your messaging apps and some emails into one application so you can monitor everything at once without having to open up different apps all the time and bounce between them to see who's saying what to you and why they're talking about you that way. But Alan just provided a nice little screen that shows you what it looks like. And it has all the popular messaging applications, whatever they are. I don't use any of them, so I forget their names. You know, there's Twitch and Signal and Telegram and who's this and what's this and who's your mama, all these other things. And it's got pretty much, it even has Skype. Can you believe that? I thought they shut Skype down, but but they have it. So I guess somebody's still using it. And there's three tiers for this. There's a free one. There you go. Free messaging service and one workspace is what you get for free. If you start at $60 a year, you can get unlimited everything and a bit of AI, cloud AI, I should say. You get AI in the, they call it AI privacy, but it's local only. So I guess you have to provide your own and feed it and care for it and walk it and all that kind of stuff. But if you pay for it, they'll give you more AI. Let me see. Sorry, that's the $60 a year is the pro version. And then there's the pro cloud, which is $96 a year. And again, it's everything the same, unlimited. But you have access to a European Union, not European Union, cloud. And what does this say? Zero retention of your data. That's it. So they're all pretty much American messaging services, but you can put them in a European cloud and whatever, if that works for you. And then if you're really turned on by this stuff, for $150, you can get it for lifetime. One shot. Now, again, I can't really review it because I haven't used it because it's not for me. But, oh, this is a very busy bunch of people. I'm sure somebody out there will have a need for this kind of thing. So go meet Franz. He's looking forward to meeting you.
Thanks, Stuart. And whoever tries it out, let us know and you can do a little share on how it works.
And Tom points out that when it's a $149 lifetime option, the lifetime of the company, not you.
Somebody's lifetime. Let's put it that way. First one out is out.
Okay, next up we have Tom. So, Tom, I think you're going to share your screen.
Will have to make him a co-host. Hang on just a second. Let me find Tom. Well, that's interesting. I don't see Tom on the list all of a sudden.
Tom and Pet.
I'm right at the top of my list.
Yeah, you're always at
near the top.
Yeah.
The display name is Tom and Pet.
Yeah, it's interesting. It normally sorts by alphabet, except for hosts and co-hosts. So make co-host, confirm. Okay, you can share now.
Actually, I get the settings as opposed to actually sharing. Let me do that again. That's a little better. Let's screen two. So, that's screen two, I guess. But now
That's showing sign into your account at BBO.
Oh, really? Strange. Okay. Let me. It's interesting. I get rid of my chat box and everything to actually open up PowerPoint. Okay. I'm beginning. Look
there we
now?
Go. Yep.
Okay. I volunteered to do a little presentation for hotspots because they're trivial. So here's my trivial presentation. Let me get this thing out of the way, too. So why would you want to use a hotspot? And this is the reason, main reason. to connect users to the internet while using your host, for example, while you're mobile, and to provide your host firewall protections to users, and to provide a local area, local network between users. So that's one reason to use a hotspot, because you're basically creating a an access point, and then everybody who connects to it is part of that little network. So what is it? It's an app or service that's provided by a general purpose device like a phone or a computer, the host, to give access to others downstream, the users, to the internet or a network connected to the host. So here's how you do it on Android. If you want to share internet access from your Android phone to your computer, for example, if you're traveling and you want to be a little safer than connecting to the hotspot in the local cafe. So you go to Settings, Network and Internet Hotspot, and then you choose Hotspot and Tethering, and you get these four choices. The ones I'm really going to be covering today are the Wi-Fi hotspot and Bluetooth tethering. USB tethering and Ethernet tethering, basically you use a wire to connect to your computer, and the wire is either a USB both ways, or it's USB to an Ethernet cable to your computer, or for that matter, to your hub. Now, here's what you get when you choose Wi-Fi. The hotspot name, you choose it, and make it clear. If you're giving internet access to a bunch of people, then you want to tell them all what the hotspot name is so they can connect up to it. For security, use this. This is the most secure and most compatible. The hotspot password you should set to be something long, like 20 characters, but easy to type, perhaps a phrase of some sort. Turn off hotspot automatically. This means when, after a few minutes, if nobody is connected and nobody is connected, it'll turn off the hotspot when everybody is not connected. Speed and compatibility, you really are given only a couple of choices here, and the default one is fine. Instant hotspot, don't use it to give access to others. You can use it only for devices all connected to the same Google account. So if you, I haven't used this, so I don't know exactly how it works, but if you're using your computer, which is connected to a Google account, the same account as it is on your phone, then this instant hotspot might connect to it. I have no idea. And then after that, on each user device, you just go to their Wi-Fi screen and choose the name, the hotspot name that you chose. On an iPhone or a cellular iPad, you should have the users nearby with their Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on. And then you go to Settings. Sometimes there's a cellular item. But if you choose cellular, then you get the personal hotspot, or it may be your directory. You allow the others to join. You set the password, long, easy to type, and then you connect on the user devices. If you're tethering, in other words, it's by wire, then if you're asked on the host to trust this computer, trust it. You can also tether by Bluetooth, and on the host, you should go to the Bluetooth screen and just stay there and pair with the user's devices. Do you have any problems? Well, perhaps the biggest problem you might have is that your cellular ISP, internet service provider, prohibits hotspots without an additional cost, and you'll have to check with them. I don't know how the error shows up on your host device. You may have, in fact, you usually should, update your operating system on the host and the users to the latest, because they probably have to be compatible in some way, and you want to avoid any bugs or any viruses that might sneak in. And host features that depend on Wi-Fi on your iPad or your iPhone, like backup, may not work with the hotspot off. So in other words, if you're at home and you want to use our hotspot for somebody, if you, the things that back up your photos or something, they may not work until you turn off the hotspot. That assumes, I think, that you're actually using the Wi-Fi on your iPad or iPhone. So there are some wrinkles. On Windows, you can use NetSetMan to automatically change between Wi-Fi and Ethernet connections. So, for example, if you set up a hotspot and have it stay active, and because your Wi-Fi, your Wi-Fi or your internet provider is flaky, but cellular costs a lot, then this will only access the cellular when the you cannot connect using your modem or your internet modem that's online. And I use this actually on my computer when I'm directing bridge tournaments or something like that, where I don't want to be offline for more than a few seconds. On Mac OS, you can use network locations to switch between Wi-Fi and Ethernet connections and between different Wi-Fi connections. Are there any questions?
I have a question from Glenn.
Glenn's asking, he says, I see WPA3 in your slide. Is WPA2 security still acceptable?
I believe so. I think it's fairly old, but the only other choice I saw when I looked there was WPA3, and then so you can choose usually WPA3. But I think the PA2 still has a fairly good reputation. I don't think it's been compromised.
I think there's a lot of devices that don't support WPA3 yet. And so if that's the case, you have to do a WPA2. But if all your devices support WPA3, why not?
Yep. And that's it. Anything else?
Just a comment from Stu that internet providers also have hotspots that customers can access to save data on their mobiles.
I don't understand that.
If I could be more clear, for example, my home internet provider used to be Cogeco, and they had a number of hotspots around Trois-Rivières and Shawinigan where their home internet providers could, if you're near one of their hotspots with your mobile, you can plug in your home internet password, username and password, and then you'd have access to the internet without using your data plan with whoever your provider, your mobile data provider is.
Cool.
I don't know about that. I do know that Comcast in the United States, they had a special modem that they would sell to customers. And I think with the customer's permission, at least I hope so, that modem could actually be used for cellular calls and for Wi-Fi of people nearby. But, of course, that would use some of your bandwidth. But, of course, they control the bandwidth, too, so I'm not sure how much of a hit that would be. So they doesn't have to depend on cellular towers. Anything else?
No, that's everything.
Oh, okay, because I don't have the chat up. I had to put the chat down to access PowerPoint. I think I have the next one as well.
You do indeed.
Okay, that is Wi-Fi Guard. And the symbol for Wi-Fi Guard is an owl, and you see a little owl in the taskbar. So that's why I've chosen this kind of presentation. So what is a Wi-Fi Guard? It's a program. It's given away by a third party. I forget who. We'll find out at the end. But it's always looking around or every so often, it pings computers and other network devices and displays those that are online. It can detect firewall computers. It can scan your network at specified intervals, like a minute or or 5 minutes or anything, whether it's Wi-Fi or if it's a wired connection. Of course, the main danger being Wi-Fi, because then people could just sneak up and steal your Wi-Fi. Well, if they steal your wires, you have a bigger problem. It immediately alerts you if an unknown device is found. You can name the devices you recognize and actually give them a little icon. It will display all the connected devices, and it's in your tray so you can open at any time. So that's Wi-Fi Guard. The status display looks like this. So it's the IP address, the MAC address. This is the kind of the Hardware Act address that a device advertises. The ping time, 2 milliseconds here. So the name, which is from the MAC, the first, I think, 4 or 6 characters identify a maker. So this, in this case, this is Asus, who's the maker of this particular device, VMB 4400 local. I believe that's a link to somewhere to that maker, but I'm not sure. I haven't used that. And so these are names. Comments are what you put in. So you can put in, this is why you put in the Internet Gateway, and then you chose, the person who did this chose this particular symbol. And then a security system, our low base station Pro 2, and a power system for the Tesla to a wall connector. First seen today. A vendor, again, identified by the first little bit of the MAC address, the technology. It says when the next scan is going to be. And as you can see there, you can scan it immediately. You can do the settings. You can see the properties of any one of the devices. You can see all devices, including those that are not currently connected. And there's a user manual. Here are the settings. These are the basic settings. Network adapter. This is in this case, it's Ethernet. And this is the IP address, the local IP address of the network adapter. Scanning options. How many can it actually send out pings to simultaneously? And how often to rescan every 30 minutes? And the user interface behavior when closing show in the notification area. Start automatically with the operating system. You might want this when closing show in the notification area, just in case some virus is wanting to close it without you knowing. If you have that done, then when closing, you'll see it. But if someone else started to close it underneath you, then you would also see that. Start automatically with the operating system, which is what I have it set as, and automatically check for new versions. The connected devices information are on this page. This is the properties page of a device. The IP address of the particular device, the MAC address. Don't ask me why the vendors today. Don't ask me why. Comment, this is where you can enter something such as Google Nest speaker, and these are different symbols you can choose to put there. So there's a chip, a question mark, a security thing, a home, I don't know. This is a tablet, I guess. That's a phone. That's a PC. That's presumably the cloud or a modem, and who knows what that is. And you can click that I know this device, and then you won't be. When it connects, if it's off and then it connects while you're logged in, then if you say I already know it, then it's not a problem, and it won't alert you. It only alerts you if they find new devices or devices that you don't know. So why would you want to use such a program? Well, you get alerts when a new device is connected. If that's unexpected, if it's not you logging in, you want to change your Wi-Fi password. You can also display all the connected live devices and, of course, have a hoop. This is the origin of it, softperfect.com, and this is where you can get the product. Are there any questions?
Don't see any.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, I am done. And thanks and credit to SlideSco for providing the owls.
Okay, let's change the share here. We should be back to square one. Now, there was a question, Tom. Is there a price for the software?
It is free.
Okay. Okay, so next up, keyboard shortcut number 17, Chris.
Yes, it's the Win plus X menu. So again, all these keyboard shortcuts are in the interest of having you keep your hands on the keyboard and you don't have to reach for the mouse to click on things to get stuff done. So if you do the Windows key plus the X key, you'll get a handy menu of options that are available elsewhere within Windows but often buried down pretty deeply. So when you hit the Win plus X, you will get that menu and it'll have an underlined letter. And so you can just hit that letter to actually invoke it, or you can use the arrow keys to arrow to an option and then press enter. And I find this actually kind of interesting. There's no official name for the Win plus X menu. And so Microsoft has referred to it as the Windows X menu, and others have often referred to it as Win plus X menu or a power user menu. You can also right-click the Start button in order to get the Win plus X menu, but, of course, that means it's no longer a keyboard shortcut. So we're going to stick with Windows plus X. So here's what it will look like when you pop it up, and you can see that all of the options have an underlined letter. So if I wanted, for example, Task Manager, I could just hit T, and it would load Task Manager. If I wanted Terminal as an admin, I'd hit A, and so forth. So just some of the options that are in there, installed apps. It basically is exactly the same as going to Settings, Apps, Installed Apps. Power options, you can get to that by going to Settings, Systems, Power. System, the systems, Settings, System, About. You know, network connections, you can get to by Settings, Network, and Internet, and so forth. So we have a number of different ways that we can actually get to all of these options. This is just a faster way to get to all of these different options. So I think it's a really good idea to get familiar with what options are on that menu, because if you frequently go to that area, like installed apps, I often am going to installed apps either to check what's installed, when it was installed, or to uninstall something. Rather than going through settings, apps, installed apps, I know that I can get it to the WinX menu, and I just have to hit WinXP, and it'll just jump me to that right away. And I think that's it for me for keyboard shortcut number 17.
Is that the same menu you get if you right-click on the start menu?
Yep, exactly the same thing. But as I said, it's hardly a shortcut. Keyboard shortcut if you right-click on the start menu.
True.
But if you forget WinX, yeah, just remember you can right-click on the start button and get that same menu.
Okay. All right, next up I have a tale of woe, I guess. I've been using these Logitech M325 mice for quite a while. They're a compact mouse, a small form factor rather than the larger kind of regular size mouse. And then recently, it started to give me a double click effect when I only did a single click on the left mouse button. So that was a bit disconcerting. And even worse, I would try and select some text and, you know, left click and then drag the mouse along the text to get something to cut and paste. And it would kind of stop partway through and only store part of the line. So I found that wasn't terribly useful. And I couldn't figure out what it was. So I went and asked my favorite AI chatbot. And it says that this particular Logitech mouse is prone to this phantom double click over time, it says. And it's because the microswitches that are activated when you actually click the button, they actually wear out. And they say generates the left button that's affected, which makes sense because that's the one you use most of the time, I guess. So it's probably going to wear out first. And they're selecting only part of a line and dropping the selection mid-drag, as it were. It says those are classic symptoms of a worn-out or a mouse button that's actually failing. So I couldn't live with this. I tried for a while, but it really wasn't working. So I decided I really had to replace the mouse. So I went to one of my favorite stores, Canada Computers, and I found that they have good prices generally. Often they have things on sale. And in this particular case, they had an iCan mouse, which is, I think, is their home brand, as it were. And it was a wireless mouse, small form factor, basically $9, which I thought was pretty good. So I thought I would buy one of these things, which I did. However, I found that I would use it for a while, and then it would suddenly start working. And that kind of took me by surprise for a little bit, but I found that if I turned it off and then turned it back on again, it worked just fine. So I think what really happens there is it's actually a battery-saving feature. If you don't use it, it just turns itself off. And anyway, that was fine, but then eventually, and after not very long, it just wouldn't turn back on again. So now I'm thinking, well, it must be the battery. So I put in a newly charged rechargeable NiCad battery, but it didn't work. And that was odd because the rechargeables used to work really well with the Logitech mouse. So again, I go back to my favorite AI chatbot, and it tells me that, well, alkaline cells, the non-rechargeable ones, are usually 1.5 volts. But if you use rechargeable nickel metal hydride, they're only 1.2 volts. And for a lot of devices, that's fine. But some devices, which they say are exceptionally voltage sensitive, they may not work with the rechargeables that well, but they'll be fine with the alkalines. But I don't like buying alkaline batteries just to throw away, so I really want something rechargeable. So I need a replacement mouse. So my answer was to go to Staples this time. And it turns out that when I was looking, Staples had these things on sale for basically 30% off. So for $20, I bought myself a brand new M325, and that's what I'm using tonight, and it seems to be working just fine. So be careful what you buy, because sometimes it's not what you think you're getting, I guess. Okay, I see somebody says they swapped the microswitch for an old mouse, and that fixed the mouse button. Well, good luck. Well done. Tim's using the same mouse. Good idea, Tim.
I have no problems with my mouse so far.
Yes.
I'll, if I remember, I'll let you know.
Stu says he's burned through 2 in 2 years. That's not all that great. Actually, mine lasts a lot longer than that, Stuart, so I'm not terribly worried about it. Oh, Josh said he swapped the micro switches out. Well, he's a techie, so he knows about that. Harvey said just throw it against the wall. That would probably do it.
Yeah, if I can interject, Alan, one of the members here demonstrated an online jigsaw puzzle game some time ago, and ever since I started playing that, I have just been beating the crap out of the button on my mouse. And that's why I'm burning through the cheap switches so quickly.
Tom said it might be just inside, so you could take it apart and see. I'll try that. And Cal says he uses a different version, tethered on a Mac Mini, and he likes it because it's small form factor. Oh, Tom's giving us some information here about AA batteries of various kinds.
Well, lithium, there are lithium AA and AAA batteries that are kind of dumbed down to not have like 4 volts But they get dumbed down to about 1.5 volts, but they last a long time. So that might be an alternative if your device needs an alkaline battery.
And a little bit of a suggestion, I should have looked at the reviews, because the Logitech mouse had 5,000 reviews and the iCan one had one review. What are the one reviews there? Okay, Chris, you're next up with data removal services.
Okay. This is a YouTube tech one. And so I came across this. I thought it was kind of interesting. And this is something that I periodically do get asked about. There are a number of services out there, and you'll see them advertised on the Internet, that they promise that they will scrub your data from the Internet so that you don't have privacy concerns and things like that. So what they are, these data removal services, they're companies that try, and emphasis, I guess, on try, to remove your personal information from data brokers and popular sites that are out there. And they usually do that by sending opt-out information on your behalf to the different data brokers that are out there. So what they do is they scan the data broker sites to find where your information is appearing. They submit removal requests, and they say often repeatedly because it can reappear. And they also monitor for new listings. And so ask Leo. So Leo Notenbaum, who we've seen a lot of videos from Leo, he has a video specifically on these data removal services. And it says, do they work? And his answer is yes and no. Mostly no. And he says that the reason why some services that say they will scrub personal information are limited is because it's impossible to remove everything. So no matter what these companies say, there's absolutely no way that they can remove all of your personal information. So the online data is going to persist. And he had a thing in there from Troy Hunt, who runs the haveibeenpwned.com, and he says, putting information anywhere on the Internet is kind of like peeing in a swimming pool. You know it's there. Removing it is just not realistic. And so Leo says that the data removal services can't undo, well, this was actually from the Troy Hunt as well, saying that data removal services can't undo a data breach. I mean, when a data breach happens, your data is out there, period. And his take on it is that data removal services are ineffective, removing the data we really want removed, and probably because of that, not worth it. So it's not the end of the world on everything. So there are ways that you can better manage your footprint out on the Internet. So first off is you should really assume that all your data is in the wild, you know, and act accordingly. Just realize that your data is out there. Be skeptical because of that. So when bad people want to use your data to create phishing emails and things like that, they can be very realistic. They can be very effective, so be careful out there. And as always, you know, watch your bank credit card statements closely to make sure that nothing untoward is popping up on there and you can react quickly to it when it does happen. And he wraps up saying, basically, all we can do is be aware. Take control of what we can, which is not everything. And he says, you know, if you really feel removing your data from legitimate data brokers is worth it, then that's your call. But Leo says it's not something that he personally prioritizes. And that's it.
Okay, Tom's got the solution. Anybody who's paranoid about this issue, he tells them you should go live in California. Because they have a delete request and opt-out platform which legally obliges these data brokers to remove stuff from the Internet.
Yeah, so that if you really do feel that removal from legitimate data brokers is worth the effort, you know, that would be the way to do it. But again, that's not going to remove all of your data from everywhere, and the people that you really want to worry about are not legitimate data brokers.
Yeah, right. Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so I put a thing in the chat saying that next up is any other questions. And Stu wants to know if 7-zip is still necessary. Who has an opinion on that?
My personal opinion on 7-zip is that they've had a couple of vulnerability come up in the program. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. I have not used 7-zip for many, many, many years, and I have no problem dealing with any archive formats that I need to. And there's been at least two significant vulnerabilities that were found in 7-zip. As far as I know, 7-zip still does not have an auto-update capability built into it, and they have no way of notifying users of the fact that there is a data vulnerability or a vulnerability in the code because it's a free program, or at least you can get it for free, and so they don't have a list of all of their users out there, so they're not going to notify you when all of a sudden a new version is available. You can't do help about and see if there's a new version, and you can't do an auto-update. I don't like programs that don't auto-update themselves. If you do, I would use something like Unigate UI to make sure that some program on your computer is checking to see whether there are vulnerabilities in 7-zip or other programs and updating them as required. But personally, I've never seen a real need for 7-zip. If anybody
can you
else
use instead, Chris, the built-in Windows extract utility?
I have used it, but I actually use the one that's built into Total Commander. So as I'm using my file manager, it just treats archives as if they're subdirectories. And so I've used it, and it actually, what does it use under the hood? I can't remember what it actually uses under the hood for doing its archive work.
I've used 7-zip for, I don't know, a dozen or two dozen or three dozen years. And the reason I like it, I mean, you can unzip things, of course, and unrar them and look into a variety of files that are archives. But the reason I like it is because it can do a very, very good job of compressing things very small. It has its own compression format called .zip. But it also does a good job with, sorry, not .zip, but .7-zip. But it also does a good job with zip and other compression utilities. And it works, it works fast on my machine, but that's not saying much since I have a big machine. But I recommend it.
Harry says that 7-zip works well on large zip files.
Well, the reason I asked the question is that I read somewhere, maybe a couple of years ago, that 7-zip has been around since the DOS days, pretty much, when it was really useful. But over time, the operating systems have incorporated archival extraction and creation into the operating systems themselves, and it's not really necessary. So I just deleted it a few years ago, and I haven't noticed any difference.
Yeah, one difference with the built-in zipping capability is you can unzip things that are password protected, and it'll prompt you for it. But I believe you still can't create an encrypted zip file using the native Windows tools. So you can create just a plain zip file, but if you want encryption, you have to use some other tool.
Go ahead.
If you right-click on the zip file, I see a menu with options. One of the options is extract all. It doesn't say, you know, open with. Is that set to whatever I have as the default?
No, that would be the built-in capability within the operating system itself.
Okay, so whatever Windows has.
Yeah, it does have, like, it has native capability for doing handling zip files. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Richard in Melbourne suggests an alternative as PZIP. which I think is open source, if I remember. I think I've used that previously.
Does it have a yellow logo?
Possibly. Okay, we have hit 8:30, so let's go into the wrap-up. If anybody has any other thoughts, put them in the chat, and we'll come back to them next week. Chris did that segment there on his YouTube video, and we like YouTube videos, and especially channels. If you have favorite videos and favorite channels, we have this segment called YouTube Tech, where you can tell us all about it. So. And we do restrict it to technological systems, so we don't want rabbits and cats and that kind of, you know, singing cats or something. But if you have a computer-related video or video channel, then just send us a note and we'll include it in our YouTube Tech series. And if you have a link which is a link to a Canadian site, and then we also have the Loony Links option. So just tell us where the site is, the URL, and basically what it does. And again, we can showcase that as a Loony Link. And for all of those who are dying to use your pen, Bridget, our hardworking newsletter editor, is probably just about to put together the next issue of the newsletter. And she would love to receive some new articles. Again, anything computer related. Doesn't have to be War and Peace. It can be fairly short. It can be fairly long. It can be a multi-part series. All contributions are gratefully received, I'm sure. So there's Bridget's email address if you want to become an author in the Ottawa PC News. And next month we'll be starting our monthly meeting series again. The second Wednesday of the month will be our monthly meeting. And we're going to kick it off with Chris talking about AI, fun and useful tips. And then October 14th, you know, we have our Vibe coding competition. So I hope everybody's working hard at developing an app or a script or something using Vibe coding, and you're going to tell us all about it and demonstrate the results. In November, we have a special presentation by a speaker from APCUG, an associated group, talking about genealogy and, in particular, websites that you've been missing. And then in December, we're going to learn a little bit about the dark web. And what you need to know and what you don't need to know about the dark web. So that's what we have for the rest of the year in terms of monthly meetings. But in the meantime, next week, August the 12th, next Wednesday, will be our next Q&A session. So if you have new questions, if you have comments and solutions on the things we've talked about tonight, if you have new topics that you'd like to share, like Stu and Tom did tonight, send us a few details, the suggestion box, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. So, hope everybody enjoyed the information tonight. Thanks to Stu and Tom in particular for their contributions, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks, and thanks to Karen for sending in her thing about tracking pixels that we were able to do some research on and come up with some slides.